have a question. Do we have any idolaters here today? Anybody here with an idol that you hide secretly somewhere in your life? Squirrel it away in your mind or put it in a closet? I want to read you an illustration and then draw the analogy to it if I can in Jeremiah 10. How many of you have a Christmas tree colored into your Bible on Jeremiah 10? Well, if you have your old Bibles, some of you would. I've seen them any number of times. Jeremiah 10, verse number 1. It says, "Hear the word of the Lord, which the Lord speaks to you, house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the ways of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven. For the Gentiles are dismayed at them. The customs of the people are futile. They're worthless. They don't have meaning or purpose. There's no gain." He says, "One cuts a tree from the forest, the work of the hands of a workman with an axe. They decorate it with silver and gold, fasten it with nails and hammers so that it will not topple. They're upright like a palm tree, and they cannot speak. They must be carried, because they cannot go by themselves. Do not be afraid of them. They can do no evil, neither can they do any good." Now, obviously, it's talking about carving an idol that is then ornamentation and dress or whatever manner of decoration is put on that and set up in that sense of temple. If you trace back as well the customs of Christmas and where the tree comes from, it comes out of idolatrous worship in an area that they worshipped, again, recognized the pine tree or the fir as the evergreen and life-giving, going back to the time of Nimrod. There's trace of that. And so we looked at this, and again, we would say, okay, here's the Christmas custom and where it came from. But specifically, it's referring to the carving and the worship of an idol. Verse 6, "Inasmuch as there is none like you, O Lord, you are great, and your name is great in might. You who would not fear you, O King of the nations? This is your rightful due, for among all the wise men of the nations and all their kingdoms, there is none like you." It's comparing this idol to God, the true God, the fact that he does have power and he can do good. He says, "They are altogether dull-hearted and foolish." But notice, it says a wooden idol is a worthless doctrine. Well, of course it's worthless. You carved it, if so be, with your own hands, and then you would worship what you yourself have made. Man has done that for thousands of years. "Silver is beaten into plates, brought from Tarshish, gold from Uphaz, the work of the craftsmen, of the hands of the metalsmith. Blue and purple are their clothing, they're all the work of skillful men. But the Lord is the true God, he is the living God, the everlasting King. At his wrath the earth will tremble, and the nations will not be able to abide his indignation." Now, we would never worship an idol, would we? We would never carve it, dress it, put ornamentation on it, stand it up in our homes and worship before it. Most of the rest of the people in our society, and I would say outside of Catholicism, wouldn't either. I would say praying to Mary would be certainly coming before an idol. They simply don't understand that's what it is. Does that mean then that there is no idolatry in the church? Well, Romans 6, look at it with a little different perspective. And verse 16, Romans 6:16, "Do you know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, what you submit yourself to, imbibe in, what you bow down to, you are that one's slaves whom you obey, whether to sin, whether of sin to death or of obedience to righteousness." You can submit yourself to God in righteousness, or you can bow down in that sense to sin or sinful thoughts or sinful ways to death. The God that we bow down to in the church most likely has not been carved out of wood or stone. Chances are much greater it's been made out of plastic or steel, because that's what the trinkets of our society have been made from. talking about materialism. Materialism is in our pores the way oxygen is in our lungs, in ways at times that we simply do not even understand. And the best way I can illustrate that is I have sometimes compared the gods of Nigeria to those of the United States. It is easy for us, if I describe them, or if you could go there, and by Nigeria, I don't mean just Nigeria, parts of Africa, maybe much of Africa. I can tell you that one of their gods is lordship and dominion, and by that I mean of the men. Power, the holding on to power, the seeking of power. And you read about that in the news. God mentions that in terms of the Gentile rulers in the Bible back in times of the apostles in the New Testament church. That has not changed. One of their gods is spiritism, which involves superstition, which is demonism in many respects of life. One of their gods is their customs and traditions. This is the way it has been done, it has always been done, and you must do it as well. Now we look at that and we would say, you mean there are peoples who are superstitious in the church? And I would say, yes. And you would say, how can that be? How can there be spiritism in the church? Well, let's just reverse that and put the shoes on our feet. The gods of the United States are freedom. We worship freedom. Freedom in the sense that this nation teaches and preaches is, goes way, way beyond what God himself ordained in the church. We worship sex. And you say, well, I don't worship sex. Well, okay, we also worship materialism. Now, if you could take the Nigerian members of the church and bring them to the United States, have them walk down the street, have them go to the feast. If you think we don't worship sex, then have them go to a feast site that is on a beach, and you see if we worship sex. And the dresses that are worn, the manner that is worn, the immodesty that is there in various places would be so shocking that some of those members would literally say, I need to go home. I'm serious. But you see, we're awash in this. So we can look at their gods and we can say, how can that be? But they can look at our gods and say exactly the same. I wonder if we even know what materialism is. Because we live it, we eat it, we breathe it. We are so absorbed in it, I doubt it is easy for us, frankly, to see. In the end time, Babylon is portrayed as what? As a merchant society. And the church in the end time is portrayed as being part of the merchant society. Rich and increased with goods in their mind. And you can say, well, that's just spiritual. No, it is part of the culture as well. They live in a society that is run and controlled. The kings, the great men of the earth, are the merchants themselves. And the church, to some degree, is in bed with them. I just have to say it is how it is. Africa could come here and be shocked. At least the church members would be shocked. The rest of Africa would be very pleased, happy to share and imbibe of the benefits that we enjoy. Just as we would be shocked by some of the things that are there. Revelation 18. Any idolaters yet? Anybody have any idols home in their closets? Revelation 18 and verse number 9. The kings of the earth, prophecy of Babylon's fall, but it also describes what Babylon is. What I believe is the Babylon that we live in the midst of. This system, I believe, is already in place. Kings of the earth, who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her, will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon, the mighty city, in 1 hour your judgment has come. So it charges and builds and expands right up until its collapse. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every object of ivory, every kind of object of the most precious woods and bronze and iron and marble. You ever go to a specialty store where they sell a wood, a specialty hardware store? They will have exotic woods from all over the world. And when Derek and I were starting into some bow carving, and when Guy Muller was making pins, and we would go and pick up these little pieces of all these different kinds of wood. I mean, it's available. It's, the earth is awash with trade in so many different fields. It could be electronics. It could be simply food, the food available on our tables. But it says wood and bronze, iron and marble, cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and notice it says the bodies and souls of men. It's talking about maybe slavery in a physical sense, but it's certainly talking about slavery in an economic sense. Bondage of this kind of merchandise, where men are sold, bought, and sold as part of the supplies of the day. And it goes beyond just simply physical enslavement, as we would remember from the times of Rome, or there are still existing in some places in the world today. The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you, and all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing. Alas, alas, the great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour such great riches have come to nothing. And every shipmaster, all who travel by ship, and sailors, as many as who trade on the sea, stood at a distance. I'm trying to read the whole passage because it is materialism that is being described on a world trading system. They cried out and saw the smoke of her burning and saying, what is like this great city? They threw dust on their heads and they cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, the great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. In 1 hour she is made desolate. So that's the system that is going to be destroyed, but it includes the bodies and souls of men. People enslaved to the system, to the merchandise, to the traders who run it. As I said, the Laodicean church, you take the end time Babylon and society, then you take the end time church that is prophesied in Revelation 3, there is a connection there, I believe. I think the connection is quite strong. Revelation 3 and verse number 17, you say, I am rich, have become wealthy, have need of nothing. It isn't talking just spiritually. God is speaking spiritually, but the people themselves are in a physical environment where they are comfortable. Their needs are being met. But you don't know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire, different than the gold that you have accumulated, that you may be rich, and white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed. Anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. Many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore be zealous and repent. Repent spiritually, but the context is in a physical environment where they are rich in that sense and increased with goods in many ways. We have a tendency to think, brethren, that if we're not living the life of Donald Trump, that we've been oppressed. I mean, we literally compare ourselves on a scale that most of the rest of the world cannot even imagine. What is materialism? Do we even know what it is that we have to be careful not to keep as an idol in our midst? Materialism is, at least in part, the love of money. I think the Bible clearly states that. Materialism is seeking pleasure from things. I'm not saying there isn't pleasure derived from things that we get to do or have at times, but materialism is seeking pleasure from things, including the love of money. Love in that sense of pleasure. 1 Timothy 6 gives reference to this. I had to chew on this. I wrote this sermon a few weeks ago, literally, and looked at it and felt like I wanted to let it, you know, germinate a bit. But just being able to crystallize and quantify what materialism is so that we will see it clearly. We don't want to not see our gods while looking at someone else's, because we might think somehow that we are lifted up in some way. We need to see ourselves in a clearer, more crystal clear light. 1 Timothy 6, verse number 6, godliness with contentment is great gain, which means a spiritual focus in which we are satisfied and happy and content in our circumstances, which doesn't mean you're happy that things are going wrong. It means we learn to live and trust God and put those things into His hands and to do our part and be responsible for the things that we do as well. But it says, godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into this world. It is certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich, doesn't say you can't have prosperity, doesn't say you can't be blessed and have increase. But those who desire to be rich, that's different, fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drowned men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. We had a discussion on the way down that when the church split, there were ministers who did not agree with the changes that were being forced on the church, but they were on payroll. And they didn't want to give up the income that they were receiving, and they tried to work their way through. And what happened? Well, the ones that I know were the very first men to be let go by the worldwide Church of God. You see, they kept the men who were the true believers. But those who compromised themselves were obvious to both sides of the issue who the compromisers were, because they did not truly believe these things. They simply went along, and frankly, they could not be depended on by either side. The Worldwide Church of God fired those men first who stayed to support them in order to receive that check. I had a man personally tell me, "I'm sorry, my wife's health is not good, and she's going to have surgery, and I have to have the medical coverage, and I cannot stand up at this time. Maybe after this is over, this year's passed, and we get through these times, then I will be able to be more open and to stand where with you." He never moved, because next year was another crisis and another compromise. And then last I heard, shortly after that, he was out putting roofs on homes because they laid him off first. I could give you literally names of individuals who personally told me they could not move for financial reasons, even though apparently we were in agreement over doctrinal matters. Those men hit the sidelines first. What would it take to have guaranteed their income? Well, they could have done what I did, what others did, what many other ministry did. They could have just stayed faithful to God. And you know what? I never missed a paycheck. I never missed one week. I had a house, had a mortgage, had a payment. I resigned from my position without a payroll. And between the severance which was given, which was thin, but the support of what became the United Church of God, which rose up very quickly, there was never so much as a week that we did not receive the payroll sufficient to pay our means. That's all they would have had to do. All they had to do is do what God told them to do. Stand fast. let God take those things into his hands. Materialism, if I say it's the love of money, then again, that's a little hard to quantify. Because we begin to ask ourselves, well, is that what I do? Do I love money? Then we could ask ourselves, am I seeking pleasure from things? So I thought, okay, let me quantify materialism a little further than that. For most of us, materialism could be identified by us going into debt. How would that be as a measure? By going into debt to buy things. Buying things on credit where the bill is never fully paid is a form of bondage and slavery to the system. Have you ever gone into debt to buy something for consumption or for pleasure or for your satisfaction? Elvis Presley lived a very bright and shining, flaming life in our culture, and he died, and they made Graceland a shrine. A shrine, I would say so. Michael Jackson did the same thing, bright, shining light in this culture, and died, and I expect that Neverland will be the same. It will be a shrine where people literally go worship something that never really existed to begin with. And by that, Michael Jackson made more money in his lifetime than we can even imagine. We couldn't imagine how big the pile of money is that he would have made if he could put it all in one spot. You know how many bills he left behind when it was all over? $500 million in debt when he was done. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. People who did more in terms of economic gain, received more than we can even imagine, have left behind destruction in terms of debt and consumption that we cannot imagine as well. Now, I'd like to say that I'm immune from that system, that I don't worship materialism, and I have to say it's not true. I am not, and neither are many of you. It is one of the gods of our culture. My family and I have lived in Spokane now a little over 12 years. We came to Spokane. We sold our house in Texas. We were able to come up with the 20% down of selling that house to get that conventional mortgage, which we put on our house. And we got a 15-year mortgage. I've never had a mortgage more than 15 years. We had a mortgage in Texas that was only 13 years. Because my idea in my mind was, someday I'd like to be able to actually pay it off. That's the idea. We don't buy mortgages, we don't take loans in order to perpetually roll them over into some new thing. Now, that's the concept. So we've been here a little over 12 years. How many years do you think's left on that mortgage? Oh, 10, 11. How does that happen? What happens when you refinance? So I think we've probably refinanced our house 3 times. Now, we did it once because the interest rates dropped. We did it once because in order to have horses for Megan, or a horse, and you had to have a trailer, and then you had to have Suburban, and you had to have all this saddles and tack and gear to run this lifestyle, and I couldn't cash that out, so we went and revolved that around, started again. I'm not sure, maybe the third time was, again, rates dropped even further, and they're offering these, we'll give it to you for nothing, and so we took it again. So we actually got our mortgage down below 5%, and it's on another 15-year, which means we probably got 10, 11 more years to go. I could take the debt on my house when we moved here and compare it to my debt on my house today, and I'll bet you they couldn't count the thousands on 10 fingers. Now, what have I gained? Well, gained a little appreciation for how things change. I was easy enough to justify that kind of decision 2 years ago, when the value of a house is going like this, and your equity and your asset least your expected equity and asset was constantly changing on the plus. Now the equity's going this way, and you start to reassess some of those, not all of them, but some of those idolatrous decisions that you made in a little different light, in a little different way. Debts are to be paid, not perpetuated and permanently promoted, and to live in that condition. That's what materialism is. Debt for consumption. I could say, well, Megan had to have horses, Derek had to have his motorcycle and work on his car, and you know what, it filled their life, and they both worked and contributed. Derek actually bought his motorcycle himself and has worked hard on his car. Megan taught lessons on horses, gave lessons, earned money, did chores. They've all contributed in various ways. But as I said, it's easier for me to justify those decisions 2 years ago than it is to justify those very same decisions today. When I look back at the last 12 years, you know what? There were a lot of dinners out on the town. There was convenience and there was luxury. And at Starbucks, there was more than a few. That's true. I know it's true. I think all of us can look in our lives and begin to analyze. Have you bought anything on debt in order to give you pleasure or in order to consume? If you did not have the cash to buy it, you probably couldn't afford it in the first place. But that's not our society, is it? Especially if you have a mortgage on a house and it's increasing. Have we bought our cars on credit? Our cars are consumed as well. We say, well, everybody has to buy their car on credit. You just have to. That's how society is. Well, that's how materialist society is. It's because we've spent the rest of the money for something else. I know. Believe me, I know what medical needs are. We've had some. Others have as well. If you go into debt because of a farm or a business failure and it's something that goes upside down in that way, that's a different issue than because you want to be able to have one more dinner and one more coffee and one more trip and one more set of clothes and one more toy or plaything or a nicer big rig or vehicle in order to cruise on down the street. It's what materialism is all about. We live in the midst of that. Proverbs 22. In verse number 26. Do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debts. What does it mean? Surety for debt. It means that you sign on and put your name on the line for a debt that someone else incurs. You're the guarantee for their debt. It says, don't be like that. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? Why should you put yourself at risk in that way? All right. So it says you really want to be careful about putting your name on the line for a debt for somebody. Wouldn't that imply that you really ought to be careful about putting your name on the line for your own debts as well? Would not the principle apply? You can say, well, then at least I have control. Fine. But you are servant to the lender. You are under the authority of him who loaned it to you in the first place. God set up Israel where their debts would be released every 7 years. He set up Israel where their land would be returned every 50 years on the Jubilee. And you think, well, that'd be a great consumer society. I'd clear the books constantly, and I'd be able to go on, and it wouldn't be such a burden that never ends. Well, that's great. So it's the sixth year of the seven, and you want some new wheels for your chariot. You think someone's going to loan it to you? It didn't work that way, because the lenders knew as well that if the debt was about to be forgiven, then the utility and the risk was about to be dramatically increased. They weren't debts for consumption. for the nice shiny new wheels on your car that didn't exist before. God says, do not subject yourself to men in slavery. Don't be slaves, don't become slaves to men. That's what it's talking about in Revelation, where it talks about the bodies and souls of men, at least in part. 1 Corinthians 7, verse number 21. Nobody would imagine that 20 to 30% interest is anything but slavery, and yet how common is that? 1 Corinthians 7, verse 21. Were you called while a slave? Well, don't be concerned about it. If you can be free, use it. That's talking about physical slavery. Are you already in debt in that sense to some man for your utility? But he is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's free man. Likewise, he was called while free is Christ's slave. That's where our bondage is supposed to be. We were purchased at a price. He says, do not become slaves of men. Don't do it. Don't indebt yourself to men. Now, we do it all the time because our society does it. We don't even think about it. We want a computer, stereo. If we want something, we charge it, put it on a system, get it on an account. Well, we'll pay that off in time, and then there's something else comes up, we'll pay that off in time. Fact is, you shouldn't have to be paying off anything in time. Now, I don't think we'd have a house. Any of us, most of us, would have a house if we didn't put a mortgage out at some point in time. So certain decisions on a very dramatic scale have to be made. But again, the point is, a mortgage is to be paid off, not to be just perpetuated eternally. The time comes when you need to have the ownership of your home. And we should live our lives accordingly so that we are in that direction and going that way. The other half of having our debts forgiven, as Israel had every 7 years, would be not to buy the things that we cannot afford to pay cash for in the first place. Again, if you're in debt because of business or a crop failure, that's on one scale. But being in debt because of acquisition and consumption is totally different. If you don't have cash, then you probably can't afford whatever it is you still don't have. That's how life is supposed to be. Luke 12 and verse 13. I don't know what the solution would be necessarily also in terms of education. I would expect that the intent would be that a person would be smarter than I was and begin to think about it when they were a young person, that the next young person that came along out of their loins that they would raise would have to go to a college as well. And so you would prepare in advance for those days. But when students go now to school, quite often a loan is taken. And it allows them the means to be able to acquire the education, to get the job that will pay those bills and clear them along the way. So I'm not saying that no debt could ever be taken. I think there are major areas where life in many respects does require it. But I think we become so accustomed to debt and so used to debt, generally speaking, our cars should be paid for. We should think of them in terms of what is it going to take to buy the next one. I think we bought that Suburban after we refinanced the house, so I guess I defaulted on that. We paid cash for the Suburban when we refinanced the house. My first car in high school was cash, $700. Every car since then was cash until I went in the ministry, and when they started paying me for mileage and I started running 4,500 miles a month in Texas, I did buy a new car and paid that off as well with mileage. So I'm trying in some respects to kind of hold that down. The car I've got right now is on 0% financing to General Motors. The car before it was on 0% financing to General Motors, and it will be paid off this spring. So I'm trying to at least walk out of some of this in a reasonable way, But we get enmeshed in it. We get buried in it. We breathe it. We sleep it in ways we don't even imagine. Luke 12, verse 13. One from the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbiter over you?" He said, "Take heed and beware of covetousness." Now, if there's an inheritance to be divided and you just want your fair share, how's that covetousness? That's obviously not the point. And Christ was addressing something a little bit stronger than that. He says, "For one's life does not consist of the abundance of the things that he possesses." We lived in Omaha, Nebraska. And one of the members in Omaha, Nebraska, as was older and their parents had died, and there was an inheritance to the estate. And there were a number of children that was going to be divided up between. The man had gone to college, worked in his job, he was careful in his funds, he was successful in the church and in society, and the time came for the inheritance, and the children began to squabble over the distribution, and he says, "You can have it, I'll take none." He didn't take a penny. The distribution was made to the rest of the children, and he said, "I would rather have my family than my receipts." He made his own way. He wasn't dependent on those things in the first place. I would say he exemplified to me that life does not consist of the abundance of things that we possess. He could have had that money and spent it and bought many things. He didn't want it or need it at the price that he would have to pay. There was a program on television a while back, not too long ago, about bank robbers during the Depression. And I happened to catch it, and it was interesting. And Pretty Boy Floyd and John Dillinger and Bonnie and Clyde, we've all heard those names. I had no idea. I had never conceived or focused on the fact that they all lived at the same time. They were all running around robbing banks at the same time. In some cases, they knew each other or even robbed banks together and then would split up and go their way. I've always thought of them as three separate entities at different times, but it was a particular time. It was during the Depression. And it went through and it showed the FBI chasing them and them running around stealing cars. And, of course, they'd steal a car with the biggest engine. They were faster than the police. They didn't have, you know, all the cameras and stuff back then we have today. Helicopters and things you could chase around in. So one series of robberies, they mentioned how much money was taken, and the last of the robberies, there was $40,000 cash. This is during the Depression. $40,000 cash in the Depression would have set you up for life. Life. You'd never have to rob another bank ever again. So what did they do? They retired on a little farm and raised carrots. No, John Dillinger headed back to Chicago to live the high life. Now that's expensive because you have to pay off your friends and you got to buy your friends favors and you have to pay off the police and you have to have all the trappings of society to be a big man, which means you're going to have to go back out and rob another bank when the loot is all gone. And so that's what happened. All of these people eventually, you know, were captured, killed. Bonnie and Clyde, they show pictures of the cars. They were all shot to pieces. John Dillinger was shot in an alley coming out of a movie theater. Pretty Boy Floyd, I don't remember exactly what his end was. So, but they once they're in there, they were in there to the end. You know, they bought into something that was way, way over their heads. And there was no finish except their destruction. I thought it was interesting. If I had $40,000 in my pocket in the Depression, I would have just walked away, I would say. If I was a bank robber, I probably wouldn't have. But you know what? It costs a lot of money to live with that much cash. Look at Ecclesiastes 5. Isn't this how it works? Ecclesiastes 5, verse number 10. It costs a lot of money to have a big house. Costs a lot of money to run a Suburban. Costs a lot of money to have things and to care for those things and to replace them and fix them. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, the love of money, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Wow. You just fly in a better seat on the plane, ride around in a better chariot with nicer wheels, and have more expenses as a result. Well, then you got to go out and rob the next bank as well. What profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? But it contrasts that. It says the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. Doesn't say he's starving. It just says, you know, he's worked, he's produced, he's productive, and he's tired. And his life is going to be filled in that way. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. It's talking about materialism. It's common to man, but boy, we have certainly bowed down to it in this nation, and it infests us in various ways. In the book of Proverbs, chapter 15, in verse 15, Proverbs 15, verse 15 says, all the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble. Verse 27, going on over. He who is greedy for gain troubles his whole house. Everybody's going to suffer. But I'm trying to provide for everybody. I'm trying to give to everybody. I want our children to have the best or the finest. They've got to have what their friends have. They need to have more of this or more of that or something else. It says it will trouble your own house. He who hates bribes, taking bribes but making compromises, will live. Isn't that amazing? It says it'll trouble your entire house. Everyone's going to suffer, but these are the ones who we're trying to protect. One of the books I read recently says the history's worst decisions. And they've got me in here about three places now, I think, in different occasions back. And the people who made them. And it starts out with Adam and Eve. Big mistake. And it goes on down, I don't know, the last one here is down to, looks like the tsunami in Thailand that wasn't protected against, and what the cost was, and what the bad decision was, and who made it. And it was interesting to just go through. It's a little bit of a history in a different way. But it evaluates why those decisions were made. And so it takes the seven deadly sins, as they are known, which was a list that was made by some cardinal hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And then it takes the three virtues, what they call the cardinal virtues, but it's talking about love and faith and hope. And it adds those together, and then it evaluates each of the decisions in terms of what the elements were that caused that decision to be made. So it has anger and charity and envy and faith and gluttony and greed and hope and lust and pride and sloth. I did give a sermon recently on sloth. It took me a while to get around to it, but I finally completed that sermon. But they have these 10 elements here, and I went through and I looked at all these different stories, and it was enlightening just to read the book. And then I looked at what the different sins were, and one of the sins that was very high on the list was pride. All of these big mistakes out of pride. But what looks to me like the very first one on the list in terms of what caused that decision to be made was greed. Greed is noted throughout the book, either by itself or in conjunction with other traits, as the reason for these worst decisions that have been made in history in all these different ways. And it went through, it talked about Nero burning down Rome and how many suffered and how much was destroyed in that city because of greed. Now, with Nero, there would have also been pride and some other things involved, but greed was tied in there. Talked about the American Revolution. What was the decision? It was the British taxes that were leveled against the colonies to try to raise funds for Britain in ways that eventually brought about the rebellion here in the United States and the loss of the colonies completely. So, I mean, they're tracing back. Let's start. Custer was listed in there. greed. What do you mean greed? Well, his desire in various ways, it spells out in terms of what he was trying to accomplish. He killed effectively every single man, his entire division, and brought about the destruction of the Indians, who then fought against them and won. See, the greed was because they wanted all of the territory and all the gold in the Black Hills, and they wanted all of the property and anything that came up that had value or merit to it, they wanted that as well. There's where the greed was. And so the Indians were basically in trouble just because they existed. You know, Sheridan's comment, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian," is one of the record quotes of American history. That's just the facts. Did that mean all the Indians were nice people and all the whites were a bunch of murderous thugs? No. We're all murderous thugs in our own culture and environment. It just depends on who gets the supremacy or authority. Mention King Leopold. Do you remember Mr. Armstrong received a watch made from a cannonball from World War I? And it was given to him by who? King Leopold. King Leopold's father is one of the most brutal, destructive dictators of Europe. And he is the one who forced the settlement, European colonial settlement, of the Congo, and subjected those people to dominion in order to get the rubber and all the products out. So it mentions King Leopold, and it was Stanley of Stanley and Livingston fame that went in and explored that area and basically was King Leopold's man on the ground. But the colonial conquest of Africa and the greed of the resources and things that were taken mentions the Titanic. It mentions Enron. It comes up to more current times. Enron was a local energy pipeline company, a regional company, that became something like the sixth largest energy company in the world as a big scam. And what Enron did was it controlled certain power systems, and it manipulated the systems in order to raise the price of the power. In other words, when California is in a heat wave and the energy needs are the greatest and Enron has access and control of certain power sources, what Enron would do is call up the power plant and ask them if they couldn't shut down for maintenance for a day or two. And the power plant would go off cycle to force a brownout in California to scare everybody into buying power that was available. They jacked the price of kilowatt hours of power up from the norm of $36 a kilowatt hour to a peak of $1,000 an hour. Now, you wonder why that name is so infamous, because there were so many crooks on such a massively large scale. So it goes through, and it just goes through this constant list of greed, 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 greed through the history of mankind. So it's not something that's just new and fresh to our time and our society. It's the way of man. But it's still an idol. And it still shouldn't be in our homes. In 2 Kings 5, there's the account of Naaman's leprosy. Let me get moving in the right direction here. 2 Kings 5. And verse number 1 says, Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, he was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master. Because of him, the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. This story has a point you may not have noticed when you read through it the last time. Remember, it says a person who's greedy for gain brings trouble on his own house. Think of it in that context as I read this out. Syrians had gone out on raids, brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who's in Samaria, he would heal him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in, told his master, and said, "Thus and thus says the girl is from the land of Israel." And the king of Syria said, "Go now, I'll send a letter to the king of Israel." He departed, and he took with him 10 talents of silver. I don't remember exactly, but let's say a talent of silver, a talent would be, what, 90, 100, 120 pounds? It's a bunch. You know, it's a bunch. 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothing. brought the letter to the king of Israel. Now, it scared the king of Israel because he said, who am I? You know, I'm not to heal. That's not to me. But as the story flows down, Elisha says, well, bring him to me. You know, I represent God. Verse 9, Naaman went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door then of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him, said, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times. Your flesh will be restored to you, and you shall be clean. Naaman became furious, and he went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, he'll surely come out to me. He'll stand and call in the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place, and heal the leprosy. And he mentions the rivers that are in his native area. He said, are they not better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? He turned and he went away in a rage. His servants came here and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says, do you wash and be clean? So he did. He humbled himself. He went down, dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to what he was told. His flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. He returned to the man of God, he and all his aides. He came and stood before him, and he said, indeed, now I know there is no God in the earth except in Israel. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. And he said, as the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing. He urged him to take it, but he refused. He would not take anything for services rendered, because it was God who gave the gift, and Elisha was not about to breach that responsibility that he had been given. Everybody, though, doesn't feel like that. Verse number 20. Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, look, my master has spared Naaman, the Syrian, while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Lord lives, I'll run after him and take something from him. Gehazi pursued Naaman. When Naaman saw him running after him, he said, go down to the chariot to meet him. He said, is all well? He said, all is well. My master has sent me, saying, indeed, just now 2 young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 changes of garments. Naaman says, please, take 2 talents. He urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of garments, handed them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them on ahead of him. When he came to the citadel, he took them from their hand and stored them away in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. He went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said to him, where did you go, Gehazi? He said, well, your servant didn't go anywhere. He said, did not my heart go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you? Is it time to receive money and to receive clothing, olive groves and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male and female servants? He obviously expanded it to an attitude and approach, the love of money. Notice verse 27, therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. Wow. You trouble your own household. When you are financially irresponsible, or when you are materialistic, or when you bow down to the god of materialism. And he went out of his presence leprous, as white as snow. God says that we have responsibility before him, that we should trust him, but that we must do our part as well. What is our part? Ephesians 4, verse 28, speaks of what it is that we must do. Ephesians 4, verse number 28. Let him who stole steal no longer. Rather, let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. It is our responsibility within the ability God gives us, within the ability we have in this society, to labor in some way to contribute. That is our responsibility. There are those who certainly do need assistance. There are those who have the need and the benefit of assistance, frankly, that comes through the social system of our government as well. And that is understandable, but that also can be a trap. Because welfare sometimes is set up in a way where, even though it might not be satisfying, because the government offers medical benefits, and offers counseling and job benefits and offers child care benefits and other things. Sometimes what they offer will trap a person from actually climbing out of that type of, can I say, in ways it becomes bondage, to success by contributing with their hands in a way that gives them a future. So I'm not saying don't take advantage of the fact that if there's social need and the government makes provision, then it is a blessing to have that. What I am saying is the people sometimes who stay there and don't move, because they actually have to go in reverse at times to get out of there. You go from having this much benefit to this much to climb out of the hole. But we should climb to the degree that we are able. There are individuals in the church over years who have been receiving disability and other things in ways in which they cannot go out and maybe hold down a physical job in the same way. And my advice to them has always been, then go volunteer somewhere, be a contributor somewhere in some way. Give it to somebody free. Help them. Do not just sit back and receive what someone else is willing to give to you. For your own character's sake, be a contributor. The Bible principle of financial maintenance is to plan ahead, to save in advance. And I think that's something we should seriously consider. Deuteronomy chapter 14. God never intended us to have to go on a credit card to the feast. What he intended was is that as the increase was received, that it would be put away at that time and protected, dedicated to God in that way. Not that we would go and then pay it back year by year from the other end. That's not what the law states. Deuteronomy 14 and verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstlings of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. It goes on, talks about if you need to turn those things into cash because of the journey and the travel, then you do so. The point being, again, it was done in advance. We have to apply that to our stereo systems. We have to apply that to our needs and purchases. We're supposed to set that aside, and when we have the means, therefore, then we can have and acquire according to our blessings. What is our focus, brethren? Let's say you sit down today, it's a Sabbath. You want to write a Sabbath note to a friend. One of the members on our Challenger program sat down when we were up in the woods there on Saturday Sabbath and sat down and wrote Sabbath notes to many of the members of the expedition and passed them out just as encouraging tokens. So you're going to write a Sabbath note to a friend. And you're going to go through in detail what your focus was last week, day by day by day, what your mind was on, what you were doing, what your values were, and what took place. What would the focus of your note be? What would you detail? Well, one of the members, coming back from Challenger Program, sent out a note on Friday and detailed what her last week was. Now, I can't say it's a typical week in any way. I'll just tell you what her note was, and it wasn't predicated on this. I asked her, I said, can I use some of this I want? She said, well, that's fine. So I'll read it to you. It says, dear friends, happy Sabbath. This is part of the team that communicates now. Hope you had as great a week as I had. If you don't want the detailed rundown of my week, just skip this next paragraph. You can go right to the end and say, I'm okay, goodbye. I left my apartment on Sunday and I headed to a member's farm for a picnic by the pond. Their family that attend in a particular church here, as she mentions, I've known them as long as I can remember. It was great seeing old friends of my family was already there. We went home after that and collapsed for a good night's sleep. Next day I helped my grandma do laundry, the Amish way, gas motor washing machine, wringer, and line dry. Obviously there must be some connections to the Amish community and her family line. I helped my aunt process 30 dozen ears of corn, which, equals 41 quarts of corn for the freezer. It's been a long time since I helped with that. Mama's ended up doing it herself a lot since her corn always seemed to ripen during Camp Heritage. She was always off at camp that time of the year. My cousin played in an all-star coach pitch tournament that night, and I got to go watch her. Tuesday was full of weeding flower beds in a garden and quilting with my other grandmother and several aunts. I honestly could quilt for hours on end. There's something really satisfying to see the progress on a quilt or any craft. I've skipped a few lines to try to flow through and not make personal comments that maybe shouldn't be shared. Wednesday night was a Good News lecture follow-up Bible study on the time of the end. It was great to go since they started when I left home after graduation. Thursday was kind of my day off, more relaxation at home than running around like the rest of the week. Mentioned something else and says, sorry for the long description. If you're still reading, I'll summarize my conclusions about the week. I miss the area I grew up in, the rolling countryside, fields getting ready for harvest, gardens, the people, getting down to earth literally. Some of the things I miss aren't things I wanted to do as much as a teenager, but looking back, it was great. In some ways, it is a somewhat simpler lifestyle, though sometimes more work. It makes me long for the agricultural lifestyle we will most likely be teaching to those in the millennium. I've been mulling over what that atmosphere truly will be like and how different things will pretty much be in every aspect of life, family structure, living quarters, sources of income, education for both adults and children. Every man with his vine and fig tree, what a glorious time that will be, especially after the devastation of the earth before the millennium can start. It will certainly be hard work to get to the ideal. And then the quote, they shall rebuild the old ruins, they shall raise up the former desolations, they shall repair the ruined cities, the desolations of many generations. Therefore, in their land they shall possess double, everlasting joy shall be theirs. Now, like I say, I don't know, I can't say that's a typical week, I have no way to know in that respect, but I thought it was interesting what the focus was on, what the opportunities were. It was on working and producing and contributing and sharing and watching the game and helping the family and working out and being productive in some way and enjoying the friendships and relationships. I thought, well, it certainly wasn't on going and shopping and acquiring and accumulating and going into debt. It wasn't on that. So again, just a vignette, but I thought an encouraging one. We were again coming down, and Paul here is giving the sermonette. He talked about Hezekiah smashing the idols when he came to be king so that Israel would not follow the idols and so that he could lead and try to contribute the way God would have him to. We're not kings in that sense. Our authority is much more limited than that. But we do have to smash those idols that are in our own lives. We have to be able to destroy those things fully and put them away. Specifically, we need to smash the idol of materialism and not buy into this world's system the way that it plays.